I am here with Tracy Loyal, who is the executive director of Domestic Violence Intervention Services in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And welcome.
Thank you.
And how old is your program and how long have you been with it?
Our transitional housing program, I believe, started the early 90s. We started originally with 8 units of transitional housing in the downtown area here in Tulsa. We've not been in that location for quite some time, but originally that's where we were with 8 housing units.
And you told me you just moved to a new location.
We did. We are now in about the last year and a half, we've been relocated into brand new 20-unit apartment facilities, all clustered together. We have a total of 3 buildings that house the apartments and then a building that houses the staff support services for the program.
So do you own those units or are you leasing them?
We own those units.
Congratulations. So how would you say that use of clustered units allows you to serve survivors that you might not be able to serve with a scattered site program?
You know, I think the primary reason we like the clustered housing model is because of the safety issues that our families have because of the domestic violence. Our facilities are gated. We have security cameras, lighted parking. Next door, we actually have staff available if there was an emergency. So on a 24/7 basis, we have access to support staff for our residents. So it's an added measure of safety, allowing our families to sort of overcome their fears and be free from the violence. And, you know, we don't often have that benefit out in a scattered site model and being able to be watchful and make sure that their abusive partner is not coming around or still making threats and causing more fear and trauma for the families. So we really like the clustered model for domestic violence victims in particular.
What happens when you have a survivor in your program who feels ready for a more independent setting, might not be financially ready to sustain that, or might still want to participate in some of the services, but might not necessarily want to be part of a communal or a community setting?
You know, if it's a family that really the safety issues maybe are not as significant or their abusive partner no longer has access to them or is in a different state or could be incarcerated or in jail, and a family would like to be in the community and scattered site model, we've been allowed to provide transitional housing and support those families with rent for a limited period of time in scattered site housing. So they can still receive the support that we offer, case management, counseling, financial assistance, help with self-sufficiency goals that they might have, schooling and employment, those sort of things. So we've been able to add that to our program. We tend to have, most of our program tends to be in the clustered sort of model, but we can assist families who are in scattered site as well.
Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned in a previous conversation that as participants in your program move toward their second year, you encourage them to take on a mentorship role with folks who are entering the program. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that kind of mentoring process works, how it benefits new arrivals, and how maybe it even benefits some of the more experienced participants.
Sure. The mentoring for new arrivals, I think the benefit to them is just to have someone who is a little bit further in their recovery from the trauma and violence that they've experienced to sort of show them the ropes in the new facility, introduce them to other residents, kind of let them know how things work in the community. It's just a great way to introduce somebody new into the community and help increase their comfort level. For the person who's been there that's sort of doing the mentoring, you know, we always talk about giving back. We talk about this a lot with our even just general volunteers here at DIVIS, that giving back for somebody who's been a survivor of domestic violence, that's often a stage in the healing process for them. So for survivors who are now mentoring other families who might be coming into transitional housing, it's that sort of that next step of healing and in giving back to their community and helping someone else who was maybe where they've been 6 months earlier or a year earlier. So it's just worked well for us to have our residents become involved in that way with each other.
Is that something that residents are comfortable with, other residents taking on that kind of role, or are there any boundary kinds of issues that you have to deal with?
You know, it becomes quite a close-knit community being in the sort of clustered housing. So certainly sometimes we do have to be careful with boundaries, or when you're living together, so to speak, and that becomes your immediate community day to day. And so we have to help sometimes define boundaries a little bit. You know, that's, again, sort of part of what our staff do, and the counselors and case managers just see and recognize those things fairly quickly and can help them work through some of those boundary difficulties. Particularly, a lot of times it's around wanting to help each other, you know, wanting to do more for your neighbor, and there's some great benefit and goodness in that, but then it also can distract residents from focusing on what they need to work on and allowing everyone to sort of develop their own support system and network, even outside of the community. So we want to encourage that. It's kind of a delicate balance sometimes, but we do have to help watch boundaries, and, you know, we're always looking for where do we want to be, or where do you want to be in the next year, and quite likely after you finish our program, you know, we want you to have support outside of our immediate transitional housing program. So what does that look like, and helping them develop relationships that are outside of that community?
Mm-hmm. Speaking of balance, one of the things that I understand that DVIS does is that you have some clinical staff as well as case management and advocacy staff, and it can be a little controversial, concerns about pathologizing domestic violence versus seeing it as a power and control issue. I'm wondering how you have balanced the supports that are clinical with the supports that are more advocacy-oriented?
I guess I'd say first, the pathologizing of domestic violence inherently is blame towards victims of domestic violence, that somehow they've caused it. And, of course, that's not our framework at all. So in terms of clinical services, we're looking at helping them deal with the effects of the domestic violence that they've experienced clinically. So we know the domestic violence victims commonly are experiencing symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, difficulty sleeping, could be difficulty regulating their emotions. So, you know, from a clinical perspective, we start by asking the survivor of domestic violence what they'd like our help with. So our clinical services are, we refer to them as empowerment-based services. They're strictly voluntary for survivors of domestic violence. So we offer a full-time counselor for the adults in our transitional housing and a full-time counselor for the children, but all of those services are at their discretion and voluntary. They're not required as part of our transitional housing program.
Mm-hmm. Do people tend to utilize them? Is it something that only a few people utilize?
Or? The majority do, on and off. Particularly, the adults seek out the support of the counselor there. You mentioned the seeking safety model. We're still using seeking safety as our, that's more of a group model. We offer group counseling services for the residents of transitional housing. You know, if they choose to come to group or choose to come and see our counselor, they make an appointment or they show up in group. And the adults tend to like those opportunities. So it would be similar for, you know, the counseling that's available to their children. We make it available. We do a lot of education to talk with them about the impact that domestic violence has on children, and the counselor's there to help them deal with that.
See, you mentioned seeking safety. Seeking safety often is focused on a combination of trauma and substance dependence. Mm-hmm. Do you use it in conjunction with both of those issues? Or
yes.
So it's not just around the trauma, but you also address substance dependence.
We do, both the trauma and the substance abuse. And we talk a lot about financial independence and emotional independence. So those are two aspects of particularly that group model, that for families who are involved in domestic violence, that those are pretty key to be able to be financially independent and emotionally independent. We consider those to be some critical areas for their success, and that model helps us address both of those as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Are the clinicians on your staff involved in supervision as well? Do they play a role in, for example, supporting staff who might be at risk of secondary traumatic stress?
In terms of the supervision, we don't have any supervisors that are supervising for specifically that reason, but one of the areas that, as an agency, that we've been really looking at lately, actually a book that all of our leadership team is reading now, and we've had a retreat for our residential staff. We did that in September of this year around the topic of trauma stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book that's written by Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, and really talks about secondary traumatic stress and how we handle that and how we experience that and in this kind of work. She talks a lot about being present with our clients through their trauma and listening to how the trauma has impacted them, and often hearing and seeing difficult things and maybe even having challenging outcomes sometimes in the families that we're working with. And so it's just like we're present with our clients as staff, we have to be present with each other. So making ourselves available when a peer or coworker needs to talk about a difficult case, a difficult session, really just being present for those things. A lot of times just having someone that you can tell and verbalize what you just heard and went through is important. So we really are promoting that book and that culture within Divas to support one another. And I think some of that is just really recognizing that as an agency that the work does impact us, and we have to take care of ourselves. Even mindfulness and slowing your workday down, and there's some great things in her book that talk about just trying to be mindful during the day and kind of grounding yourself when you've had a day that's been rapid, client after client, and in our cases, hearing different kinds of trauma all day long. I think they say children's counselors are most at risk because of the type of trauma and working with children. It tends to impact children's counselors at a higher rate than adult counselors. So we're really just trying to be mindful of that at Divas and start holding each other accountable. We talk about peer accountability. In your work areas, you know people pretty well. You know each other pretty well. And when you recognize that someone is a look on their face or their mannerisms or behavior is different and you know something's wrong, to act on that and to ask and give that other person permission to share what's going on. And so we're trying to just implement that. We don't have any one in particular that's in charge of that. We're really trying to make it part of our culture with each other, even mostly on the front lines, but even we are really doing it, like I said, as even a leadership team, and trying to promote that with each other as well.
I talked to a number of other programs that also were impressed with the approach that that book and the trauma stewardship approach takes, and we're very happy with that. So I wish you a lot of luck, and it sounds
Thank
like a
you.
Really
yeah.
good decision on that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very helpful to us.
I wanted to ask a couple of questions about the way you work with families with children. You mentioned that you do have counseling for the children. You mentioned that you work with the parents about the impact that exposure to trauma and abuse can have on the children. There has in the past been a little bit of tension about whether staff are the advocates for the parent or they're the advocates for the child, and how to avoid pitting one against the other. And I'm wondering how you have navigated that challenge.
You know, we tend to treat the parent as, you know, they initiate oftentimes the treatment for their children. So, again, it's a service we offer that's voluntary and, you know, that they can take advantage of. And we often start with what behaviors or things the parent is wanting to work on with that child, or what behaviors they're seeing in that child that they would like addressed. You know, if you had a teenager who wanted to sort of define their treatment goals, we would have the teenager talk about what they want to accomplish in counseling and have the parent talk about it and try to come to some agreement about what that looks like. So I don't think we have a lot of challenges in terms of child and parent and being competing approaches. We try to focus on the parent, particularly for the younger kids, to have them tell us what they'd like to work on. Now, oftentimes, if the parent wants to work on things and is maybe not acknowledging things that the clinician might see, certainly we would try to bring those to the parent's attention and say, you know, these are some things we're seeing in behaviors of the child or in interaction between parent and child, and try to give some voice to what those are and see if the parent's willing to take a look at those. We have two case managers that work in our transitional housing, so they often are the ones that help with school enrollment, transportation if that is a challenge, and ISPs, you know, if there's issues that come up that particularly the children's counselor would see, they would also get involved with talking with the school and helping the parent with those kinds of issues. We're fortunate that the school that our children feed into in Tulsa, you know, they know us and we have a good relationship with them. We find the schools really willing to work with our kids to help them through some of those challenges, and we feel pretty fortunate about that.
Is the school able to work with preschool age children around assessment, or do you have other resources that you're able to call on?
We have about 4 different EduCare programs in Tulsa. You know, infant to, I believe, 4 or 5 years of age. And so it's a early childhood model that involves a lot of developmental support, social workers, and family support for kids who attend EduCare. And so we can refer, obviously, our parents to have their kids enroll in an area EduCare program. There's also early Head Start programs. So a lot of the younger kids, those issues would be addressed in early Head Start and EduCare programs.
That sounds like a sort of a nice continuum.
Yes.
You were telling me that your program was one of some of the transitional housing programs that were not refunded in the most recent HUD competition. How are you handling that? What's that going to mean for you, do you think?
Well, of course, we were a little shocked by that this year. Our funding from HUD will be ending the end of 2016, and that's particularly the HUD transitional housing funding through the continuum of care. So for DIVIS, that's about $149,000 a year. So that's caused us to have to just do some local fundraising, working with Tulsa and talking with foundations and trying to make up the difference that we've lost in the HUD funding. At this point, we're staying fully staffed at our current capacity, anticipate being able to do that through at least half of 2017, but we're still fundraising. That really was the HUD's movement to focus most on permanent housing rather than transitional housing. You know, I still feel like transitional housing is an important program, particularly for survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault, because of the safety issues that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So, we're managing. We're going to continue to raise money and talk to people about funding this program. It's really a program that has, we feel like, a lot of success because we have a lot of face-to-face time and with the families who are in our program. So it's up to 2 years that, in our experience, gives families the time they need to heal from what they've experienced and gain the support that we offer and look at things that are going to help them become self-sufficient and more emotionally and financially independent, as I mentioned before. We really have had some great success from families increasing their income while they're in our transitional housing program, from the time they come in to the time they exit, and having increased their income, we have great success in them maintaining their housing once they move out of our transitional housing program in the community and just remaining in that permanent housing. So it's an important step. We feel like they're going to keep the program operational as long as we can.
I wish you a lot of luck. It sounds like just the fact that you have your own building and have been able to support the variety of staff that you have been successful in being able to raise some private resources as well as your OVW and HUD grants.
Yes, we are fortunate. The new building that we're in, obviously a result of a capital campaign, so we're really fortunate in Tulsa to have a very generous community and philanthropic community that cares about domestic violence and sexual assault here and supported building new facilities, and they've also supported our program, so we're hopeful they'll continue to do that.
Well, again, I wish you a lot of luck, and thank you so much again, Tracy, for taking the time for this interview.
All right. Thank you, Fred.